Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
On the program today, some of the economic realities that become clear the longer things go on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the fourth day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today by noting the passage of time. We are a week, give or take, into the protests over George Floyd's killing. A week of almost entirely peaceful but occasionally destructive protests and the ramifications of those attacks on businesses is now, a week in, becoming clear. Some neighborhoods, often the most vulnerable, have been left with few, if any, functioning grocery stores and pharmacies and the like. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going.
There's a 6-mile-long commercial corridor in South Minneapolis called Lake Street, and it has been just destroyed. Zoana Martinez works for the Lake Street Council, a business association.
We no longer have pharmacies in our community. Our medical clinics also have been set ablaze. Our largest grocery stores are also gone. Right now, our community, we live in a food desert, which happened overnight.
In Minneapolis and St. Paul, hundreds of businesses have been damaged or burnt to the ground. The same has happened in cities around the country. Bea Ryder is interim executive director of NKCDC, a neighborhood group in Philadelphia.
Pretty much half of a city block completely burned down Sunday night.
Pharmacies, bodegas, clothing stores, check cashing spots, all gone. And these losses hurt certain groups more than others.
Low-income families who are underbanked, so if they rely on check cashing businesses, they're definitely feeling a pinch.
Also, people who don't have cars to drive to an intact store in the suburbs, and seniors who may have trouble getting around and who are more likely to need prescriptions filled.
This is all in the background as the pandemic is still very much with us, and some businesses, right, had curtailed certain degrees of operation because of that.
That's Tabitha Montgomery, executive director of the Powderhorn Park Neighborhood Association in Minneapolis. Community groups and churches are trying to fill the gap with donated supplies, but that's a short-term fix. And Montgomery says she thinks the neighborhood will bear the scars of this moment for decades, even after the stores are rebuilt. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
A very quick primer now on another second-order effect going on in this economy, the hit that state budgets are taking because of the pandemic. Marketplace's Andy Euler holds forth from Austin, Texas.
Texas collected a whopping 13% less in sales taxes last month than it did in May of 2019.
Look, revenues are way down. There's no question about it.
Michael Granoff is an accounting professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
Well, they have to cut somewhere. Well, what do they spend their money on?
Well, public education, for one thing. It's the state's biggest expense. Cal Gilson teaches political science at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He says Texas is already near the bottom in per capita spending on education. Cuts will bring long-lasting economic pain.
Everybody understands that education is preparation for the workforce. So Texas is truly between a rock and a hard place, and it's likely worse than that. But on the radio, we can't be too descriptive.
Gilson says Texas will also have to reduce healthcare spending, another big budget item. And things like highway maintenance will be delayed, too.
So we are going to cut the balance and then hope that we can replace those revenues in the coming years without doing irreparable damage.
Texas is one of 7 states without an income tax, which means it relies on sales taxes more than, say, California or New York. But Michael Leachman at the Center on Budget and Policy Priority says right now, all states are in the same boat.
you pray that the federal government's going to step up to the plate and provide some relief soon. You can also draw on your reserves. Besides those things, you don't have good options.
He says the federal government has tried to help state and local governments as part of the different COVID-19 relief packages, but most are going to need a lot more cash before revenue collection picks back up again. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, maybe, just maybe, traders looked around and said, oh, no, this is bad. This is very, very bad. And then again, maybe they didn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of companies have come out the past week or so, a lot of the big brand names, with messages of support for the black community and for peaceful protest. That's for public consumption, of course, because brand is everything. But employees of those companies that are being publicly inclusive are watching real closely what their bosses are saying in private. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
When Shedra LeBouvier saw a former employer post on social media that it stands in solidarity with those demanding justice and an end to racism, her immediate response was
total disbelief,
because that's not how it felt when she worked there. What a company says or posts to the public can be very different from how it actually deals with its own employees.
The statement means nothing unless they back up that statement with some kind of action.
That's Kathleen Fern Banks, a professor at the University of Washington, who's written a textbook on corporate crisis communications. She cites positive examples, like Starbucks briefly shutting down for part of a day in 2018 for racial bias training, or companies pledging to hire more people of color in leadership positions and following through on those pledges. John Bruce Tracy, a professor of management at Cornell, says some companies are realizing
how they've treated people during this very, very difficult situation is going to reflect on how well they're able to pick up the pieces once the, you know, various, you know, anxieties, tensions and uncertainty is passing.
Tracy adds this will impact companies' ability to attract and retain employees in the future.
Could I work for a company that doesn't have the same values as I do?
That's Amy Klein. She works for Patron Technology. On Blackout Tuesday, her company gave employees the day off to reflect or protest. Klein says now that's as important as any other benefit she receives. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The macroeconomic number of the day is 1.877 million, if you want to get specific, which we do. That is the number of first-time claims for unemployment benefits filed last week. Still insanely high. The trend, though, is down, which is good. But millions of Americans have lost income these past 11 weeks. And when people have less money in their pockets, they spend less, which in this particular macroeconomic situation isn't great. Because we all want this recession to end, right? Economists being economists, they have a theory about consumers and the choices that we make in a recession, a theory popularized back in the 1930s by none other than John Maynard Keynes, called the paradox of thrift.
It is a market failure.
Okay.
By which individuals decide not to spend, but rather to save, hoping that they'll get a better price the next day.
Because?
They are keeping money and not spending it because they think that they should have precautionary savings.
That's Lisa Cook. She's a professor of economics at Michigan State University. Maybe it would be helpful to have an example from the recent past, huh?
New car sales plunged in 2008.
About 18% that year.
The car companies were giving all sorts of incentives to try to get people to loosen their pocketbooks. They were offering employee discounts.
didn't really work, though.
What we saw parallel to that was that the average age of cars on the road was the highest it had ever been in the United States.
So even with all those discounts, people weren't buying.
That really drove car sales down, or kept car sales down.
Until 2011. So let's look at now, okay? This April, the household savings rate in this country hit 33%, the highest since 1975. Consumer spending, not coincidentally, hit a record low that month, dropping 13%, because
there's uncertainty. And when there is uncertainty, people often, households often, want to hold on to their money because they don't know what's coming up next.
And therein lies the paradox. Consumers are saving, not consuming, and all of that saving is a drag on the economy.
This is a problem because consumer spending makes up 70% of GDP. And if people aren't spending, then economic activity and GDP will fall. And that will create a vicious cycle.
How far is GDP going to fall? The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta has revised its estimate. It now figures the economy is going to shrink 53%, and this is important, 53% on an annualized basis in the second quarter. Our next explainer, by the way, is going to be annualized growth rates. Special thanks, of course, to Lisa Cook at Michigan State for helping us out today. Coming up,
food trucks are serving suburban communities that are very well connected.
Food trucks are going to the suburbs, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, up 11, 26,281 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 67 points, that is just shy of 0.7%, finished at 96.15. The S&P 500 down 10 points, about a third percent, 31.12. The financial sector was one of the few bright spots. European Union stimulus packages helping to push interest rates higher, and that in turn helped push shares in the big banks higher. That's the way that worked. Wells Fargo, come on, guy, gained 4.8%. Citigroup picked up 4.33% today. American Airlines announced today it's going to be resuming a lot of the flights it canceled during the pandemic. Expects to be back to operating about 55% of its schedule by July, which is huge. Shares in American, this is also huge, picked up 41% on that news. United Airlines gained more than 16%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 0.82%, which is, relatively speaking, high. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a group called the Center for Responsible Lending, which wants lenders to be, obviously, responsible. But more than that, not to be predatory. Anyway, it's out with a new report this week showing banks collected more than $11 billion in overdraft fees last year, and that vulnerable people in vulnerable communities paid the lion's share of those fees. And that was before the pandemic, which has strained the finances for millions of people. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
As Americans have lost their jobs during the pandemic, disadvantaged groups have taken a disproportionate hit to their bank accounts, says economist Damon Jones at the University of Chicago.
If you don't have liquid assets and cash to fall back on, you're more adversely affected by these income shocks.
The Center for Responsible Lending found that over 80% of the people paying overdraft fees had an average of less than $350 in their bank accounts. Tyrone Ross is a financial advisor based in New Jersey. He says those fees can bleed people dry.
Perfect example. Let's just say my rent is due on Monday. I get paid on Friday. My account has $20 in it. That check won't clear until Tuesday. I pay my rent, it bounces. Now I get hit with that fee.
It's a problem that causes pain in minority communities even during normal times, says Jose Quinones. He's the CEO of the Mission Asset Fund, a nonprofit group that's been providing grants to immigrant families during the pandemic. Quinones says the crisis has made the problem worse.
It really does call for a rethinking of that fee, putting a pause to that fee.
A spokesperson for the American Bankers Association said banks have been waiving some fees and deferring payments during the pandemic. Quinones says pausing overdraft fees would go a long way to helping vulnerable communities.
We need to allow for, you know, creative solutions to come to the fore, because that financial pain is going to get even deeper in people's lives.
But so far, creative solutions are thin on the ground. According to recent research from the Harvard Business School, banks' income from fees on deposit accounts has risen by 3% so far this year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There's a certain collective experience thing that's come along with this quarantine. Not everything, but some things are pretty common. One of them, a lot of us are shopping differently. Consumer spending is way down. We talked about that and the paradox of thrift, right? Also, when we spend, we are buying different things. Jigsaw puzzle sales up 370%. That's year over year, because you got to stay entertained, right? But there are those for whom quarantine is doing something different. From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, Marketplace's Rima Kreis has the story.
Beth was 21 the first time she used a credit card. She was at Ulta Beauty and picked out a makeup brush, then handed her card to the cashier.
It was literally like in a movie, you know, like when you find the Holy Grail and something's glowing and you're just like, music from the angels. It was kind of that moment where I was like, oh my God, I have money.
Beth says her mom was a single parent and they always struggled financially. So when she got that first credit card back in 2014, suddenly it felt like she could pass as someone with money. In fact, that night after going to Ulta, she sat on her bed and opened 5 more credit cards.
Like apply, approved, apply, approved, apply, approved, and just one after the other.
And from that point on, every time something went wrong, like a bad grade on a math test or a nasty breakup, Beth would buy something and get caught in these mental loops.
You know, I would feel really bad about myself, and I would immediately turn to shopping because that was always there.
What Beth is doing, compulsively buying things, can actually be a serious behavioral addiction, an addiction that usually takes over other parts of someone's life. For Beth, she was racking up hundreds and thousands of dollars on her credit cards, and within a year, she'd maxed out all her cards. Did you consider yourself a shopping addict?
I did not. Not at that point. Because I kind of felt like, oh, you can stop at any time, which is so cliche because I feel like anybody who suffers from an addiction of any type says that.
For a while, Beth even took on a second job to basically sustain the shopping. She'd still make her minimum payments, but would struggle to afford essential things like drug prescriptions or even food. But she didn't tell anyone.
Instead of letting them see how stressed out I was, I would only let them see how happy it made me.
At the height of things, she had 16 credit cards and was nearly $60,000 in debt, which also included her car loan. And that's when it became painfully obvious.
It wasn't my income. It wasn't my lack of ability to pay off these cards, you know, pay more than your minimums. It was me.
And up until recently, she thought it might always be like this. But then the pandemic happened. And being stuck at home means she's not spending $40 a week on gas or making trips to the mall.
And that was sort of what made me feel like, oh, I can start actually paying off some debt. It felt like the universe was telling me, okay, now's your chance. Do it now, or you'll never have this chance again.
So she took that gas and shopping money and put it towards one of her credit cards. And lo and behold,
I was like, oh my God, I have one paid off.
Then she put her relief check towards the debt.
And when I started to watch those balances go down, it became a new addiction.
She was feeling so great just paying down all this debt. But then her progress stalled. She just found out she got furloughed and lost her income of about $37,000. So now her focus is on saving. Beth, who lives in Michigan, says she's nervous of falling back into her old habits now that stores there are starting to reopen. But she keeps reminding herself,
don't go backwards. Don't pedal backwards. Just know that you owe it to yourself to work towards a better future for yourself.
A future that, she says, is hopefully debt-free. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
More great stories about money and how it makes things weird on our podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, wherever you choose to download. There used to be a pretty regular parade of food trucks outside our studios in downtown Los Angeles. Of course, our offices, like so many, are still pretty much empty and have been empty for months. So where have all those food trucks gone? Matt Geller is the founding president of the National Food Truck Association. Also, he runs a platform called Best Food Trucks, which is food trucks online, basically, which means if you want to know where the food trucks went when the offices shut down, he's kind of the guy. Matt Geller, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You saw this happening kind of in real time as people started not patronizing food trucks, right? Tell me what you knew and when you knew it.
We knew it pretty quick because all of our lunches dried up. Food trucks traditionally have had lunches as their bread and butter. And within a week's time, we saw every lunch just shut down. And so our job was to figure out what was next. We changed our app. We've updated our app 6 times in 6 weeks for more features, easier features, better features for the trucks. This traditionally lunchtime business turned into almost exclusively a nighttime, evening, you know, go into a neighborhood, have people online order, and then pick up their food.
Interesting. Let me back you up for 2 seconds. Online order, because traditionally my experience with a food truck is you walk up, you look at what they got, you say, I want, you know, whatever it is, and you hand over your $6 or $8. That is changing, I hear you saying?
When we launched online ordering 2 years ago with Best Food Trucks, trucks were like, oh, that'll ruin my business. I can't have that. But when this happened, everything changed. We need online ordering. We need it now. And then it was, we need online ordering. We need pre-order. I want to be able to, I want my customers to pre-order 24 hours in advance. And then it was, I want them 48 hours in advance. So, I mean, it has been a paradigm shift that came with basically in 1 week.
Yeah, I wonder if this is a little bit of false romanticism, but doesn't that kind of take a little bit of charm away from the food truck, right? You happen to see one outside your office, you go out and you have whatever they're offering, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference now and what we're seeing in these communities, people are getting the text message when their food is ready, but they're going a little bit early. And they're all just social distance around the truck. So I think we're going to continue on with the evening shifts. They're going to continue to grow. People are going to be excited about it. And it's going to be a replacement for the big summer events. And then you are slowly going to see the lunch events creep back in as more and more people come back to work.
Yeah. On that word replacement, for all of the hustle that these trucks are doing to get online and pre-orders and all of that, it's not possible that they've been able to replace all the business that's been lost, right?
It depends on the region. I would say that Los Angeles has had a very hard time. But places like Nashville, Austin, Tampa, they're doing so much suburban business. They're doing almost more. I mean, a lot of them more than they've ever done. You know, for Nashville, we book locations. I'm out of trucks. I can't. There's no more locations to book until there's more trucks open.
So what is it about Nashville that's making it work so well, whereas in LA, maybe we're not, or Chicago or whatever?
Well, traditionally, you'd think more dense, better. Now, the suburbs are so well connected in a lot of communities. Unlike Los Angeles, where I talk to one person from one area, and she runs the Facebook page for 400 homes. And when she says a food truck's coming, everybody knows it. The truck goes there, and they knock it out of the park. Food trucks are serving suburban communities that are very well connected because they don't have to you know do advertisements or social media. They just have to get a hold of the one person that runs the Facebook page, or the next door page, or even some communities. Everybody's on the same WhatsApp stream that we're dealing with. So you get to one person, you get to everybody. And that's much more of a suburban thing than a dense city thing.
Matt Geller, he's the founding president of the National Food Truck Association. Also, their online company, it's called Best Food Trucks Incorporated. Matt, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, which I am not entirely sure I understand, but here you go. One of the big winners in this pandemic, Campbell's Soup. The company reported quarterly profits yesterday, sales up 35%, and the CEO told CNBC they, and this is a quote, expect the stickiness, if you will, of these consumer behaviors to continue moving forward. Again, I'll take a bowl of Campbell's chicken noodle every now and then, but I don't know. All right, we got to go. But first, here is your moment of economic context for this Thursday. From the Labor Department this morning came a report on worker productivity down 0.9% in the first quarter. So, number one, productivity growth is really important. It is a key to overall economic growth. But also, number two, the first quarter was January through March, right? The big tell is going to be Q2, which is April through June. We'll keep you posted. The biggest tell, though, tomorrow morning, the May Jobs Report, David Brancaccio and the Morning Gang are going to have it for you hot off the presses. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.